Welcome to Legal Aid Matters, a podcast from LAF, the largest provider of free civil legal services to low-income Chicagoans. On the show, we'll introduce you to the advocates who stand up for our clients, discuss how events in the news affect our work, and share stories on how we use the justice system to alleviate poverty. Now, here's your host, Nubia Willman.
Welcome to Legal Aid Matters. Today we hear from Micah Held, a staff attorney in the Children and Family Practice Group. Micah discusses how she advocates for sex assault survivors and how the Me Too movement has shed a light on the clients LAF serves.
Episode. I knew she was on it and I asked her for advice about this episode.
Oh, good.
But I did not listen to it. I hate podcasts.
Oh no.
I'm a podcast hater. Yeah, I never listened to Serial.
So. Oh no. Serial was, I think, probably my gateway podcast. Actually.
I think for most people.
It was like Thanksgiving time, so it was like quiet in the office, and I think I listened to the entire series in one day. So. Did you hear it and you just didn't like it, or you just didn't even try?
I couldn't try. I don't like listening to things.
Interesting.
I really like reading. Like,
do you listen
I have
to music?
Like, a little bit, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. I just can't listen to words. I'd rather like really read it on a paper listen to it.
That makes sense. I mean, you have to pay attention to the podcast, and it's hard, I think, to listen. Yeah, right? So that's interesting. Well, maybe we'll make a convert out of you today. We'll see. Thank you for joining us. I'm here with Micah Held, our staff attorney in the Children and Family Practice Group. Thank you, Micah, for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And so we have you here today because we want to talk a little bit about the work that you do and the specific project that you are a part of, which I'm a part of as well, and just give everyone kind of a feel of the specialty work that we do here in LAF. So if you could tell us just a little bit about your position here.
You mean outside the project?
No, just what you do in general.
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, I'm a staff attorney in Children and Family Practice Group, and I specifically specialize in family law. So that's helping mostly domestic violence and sexual assault survivors get a divorce from abusive spouses. Sometimes it's a parentage case where the parties weren't married, and we're helping our client seek parenting time of their child. I also work on orders of protection cases, and that could be any of the three different types we have in Illinois. That's an order of protection, a civil no contact order, and a stalking no contact order.
Okay. And when I mentioned the project that you're a part of, can you tell people a little bit about that?
Yes. For years, LAF has been working with domestic violence survivors. We have a lot of expertise in that area. We started the CLASS project so we could specifically work with sexual assault survivors, which often in our work, especially in family law, we already do. However, the CLASS project focuses on sexual assault survivors of non-intimate partner violence. So typically in the cases we do with domestic violence survivors, there's often sexual assault within the relationship, but the CLASS project focuses on the cases where there's not necessarily that pre-existing relationship. So if an acquaintance or friend or other type of family member that's not your romantic partner sexually assaults you.
Okay. And so I'm a part of that CLASS grant as well, the project. We were both part of the first iteration of CLASS, but now we've moved on to what we call CLASS 2, I guess, internally. And we definitely learned in immigration and employment a different legal tools that were available for sex assault survivors. And so you mentioned a little bit of the orders of protection and parentage and divorcing. And usually, I think as you mentioned, this part of the domestic violence kind of a toolkit for advocates. What is some of the tools that you have for someone who's not married or the offender was not a partner? How do you protect those clients or help them enforce their rights?
So in Illinois, we have a few special statutes that not all states have that help us work with sexual assault survivors, particularly those affected by non-intimate partner violence. The first is the civil no contact order. It's specifically for somebody who's been sexually assaulted. And unlike the order of protection statute, it doesn't have to be somebody who's a former dating partner or a current dating partner. It can be anybody who sexually assaulted you. So we're very lucky in Illinois to have that for our survivors. In addition, we also have a recent law in Illinois where we can prohibit fathers who rape someone and a child is conceived as a result, we can prohibit those fathers from having any parenting time or decision making over the child. Mm-hmm. As we know, sometimes when people are sexually assaulted, they do get pregnant and choose to carry the pregnancy to term. And we have had cases here at LAF of fathers in those situations mm-hmm. trying to get rights, decision-making rights over that child. So in Illinois, we are very lucky to have some of these statutes to help protect people who aren't necessarily the victims of intimate partner violence.
Mm-hmm. So you said that means that in other states they don't have access to these laws, just haven't passed there yet.
That's right. There are some states that have either one or both of these laws, but not all of them.
Interesting. And you mentioned there's also an SNCO. Can you tell me the difference between a CNCO and an SNCO? So maybe I can remember once and for all.
Yes. Well, orders of protection require a appropriate relationship between the petitioner, the person seeking the order of protection, and the respondent, the person they want the order of protection against. With civil no contact order and stalking no contact order, you don't need that qualifying relationship. So with a civil no contact order, as I mentioned before, it's specifically for people who've been victims of sexual assault or an attempted sexual assault. And a stalking no contact order is for people who are being stalked, and there has to be two or more incidents and it can be anyone, because mm-hmm. we know that sometimes people target people they don't even know to stalk them.
I see. So then the CNCO might be prior to an act of violence, usually, we're hoping.
You mean the SNCO?
I'm sorry, yeah. Did I mess it up? See, okay, yes, the SNCO is used prior to an act of violence, and the CNCO is to address some act of violence or an attempted act that has happened.
Yes, okay. Although sometimes we go for an SNCO, mm-hmm. even in sexual assault cases where we have other incidents that aren't sexually abusive, mm-hmm. but they would fit under the stalking, and that's so we can include all incidents.
Interesting. Okay. And so are these easy to get?
It depends what side of the court you're on. Some would say that they are easy to get. Mm-hmm. You know, practicing in this field, I don't think they're always easy to get. It really depends on the judge, on the specific facts of your case. It depends on a lot of things, but I will say it does seem like it's easier to get orders of protection than it is to get civil no contact orders or stalking no contact orders. And I think that's partially because judges are very skeptical of stalking no contact orders. A lot of times people are bringing them against neighbors, something that's mm-hmm. not really appropriate for the domestic violence courthouse. And civil no contact orders, I think, are harder to get because there is not as much education on sexual assault. Judges have had a lot of education on domestic violence, and to some extent they mm-hmm. understand domestic violence, but it's harder for them to conceive of somebody sexually assaulting someone else.
That's interesting because, I mean, to me that doesn't seem like I am aware that sex assault happens, and so it doesn't seem like such an incredible thing to believe that someone may need protection from it. So what are some of the barriers that you're seeing in court when someone is trying to obtain a CNCO?
Some of the barriers for a CNCO is you can go for the civil no contact order at any time. So sometimes we're getting cases that are older and it can be hard to prove a sexual assault years after it happened. In addition, sexual assault is often done in private. So there's often no witnesses. It can be hard to obtain corroboration. A lot of people go to the hospital afterwards, but you can't tell when someone's been sexually assaulted. Oftentimes, the perpetrator says, "We had consensual sex." Mm. And it's pretty easy to tell when you're doing a rape kit if there's DNA, semen, but the doctor can't say, "Well, this was by force."
Sure.
Or this wasn't consented to. So I think those are some of the struggles that we're having proving sexual assault cases. Mm-hmm.
And so does this really mean that it's up to the client, the person petitioning, to make a credible case about what they're alleging?
Yes, or it's up to me as their lawyer to make the case.
And so, I mean, that seems, me working with mostly domestic violence and sex assault survivors, my clients make the case, but it's almost always written. And we're rarely ever in court or in front of an official where we have to really plead and tell this basic stranger what happened. But that's completely opposite in your world. You definitely have to have that happen. So how do you navigate that? Because that's incredibly tough for the client. And could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I'll say similar to most other areas of law, most of these cases end up being settled, which of course is really beneficial for our client. Oftentimes they don't want to testify in court. But one of the unique tools that we have in the civil no contact order statute, which is unique to that statute as opposed to the other two, is that you can petition the judge to allow a victim of sexual assault to testify in chambers. And if they were to testify in chambers, the respondent, the person they're saying sexually assaulted them, can't be in there. Their lawyer can be in there, but as you can tell, that would be less intimidating to have the perpetrator's attorney rather than the perpetrator themselves. But of course, it's always hard, no matter who you're telling, it's always hard to tell your story in an official capacity, and we do have to spend a lot of time preparing our witnesses for that testimony.
One of the things I've noticed in it, through this grant with the work when we started doing more services for sex assault survivors, was just how difficult it is for many of them to express what happened to them in a chronological order. And that obviously impacts the way people view them as credible. And so we have been trained, and I think we both understand about the neurobiology of someone who's living in trauma and how it impacts how they view things and how they state things. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It is the most difficult thing is when, before I've even accepted a case, when I'm intaking the case and I'm trying to get to the bottom of what happened, because I agree, we know that best practices are to let a survivor tell the story the way they want to, but often to us as attorneys, it doesn't make sense. Things are out of order, details are out of place. So that is another challenge of preparing for hearing. It's fine if they tell me the story in that way, but when they get in front of a judge and another attorney, I certainly want it to be in a chronological narrative because that's the way most people understand stories. So again, sometimes it can take two or three different times preparing for testimony because it is challenging for survivors to get the story in chronological order.
We definitely have had cases where, you know, where we see the client can't even remember. And I remember one of my first bigger cases after I then went to a training, I realized, oh, it wasn't that the client blacked out or just didn't remember. It was literally the body was responding to shock and trauma during the incident. And so they could not physically remember. And how do you translate that to court when a judge is expecting them to be able to say, like, on this night, on this date, X and Y, Z happen? It just seems like there's a big gap there. I want to talk a little bit about the gaps and also, especially with the Me Too movement, how our work is impacted by that and how we're hoping to impact that movement. But before that, we want to take a little break and we'll be right back.
This is Ashton Shelton, External Relations Coordinator here at LAF. Our work makes a difference in the lives of more than 30,000 people living in poverty across Chicago every year. We rely on your contributions to provide quality civil legal services to the most vulnerable members of our community. To support our work, please visit laf.org/donate.
You're like, there's one in Puerto Rico. Can I please go? All right. Well, we're back with Micah Held, who's a staff attorney in our Children Family Practice Group, and is talking to us about the special practice or project that we have here in LAF called CLASS, which is the Comprehensive Legal Survivors Project. And we wanted to talk to Mike a little bit about the gaps that we see when we service sex assault survivors, and particularly right now with the Me Too movement. I think that really kind of put sex assault survivors in the spotlight about things that were happening to them and how both maybe the criminal justice system and the civil legal system is not serving them as well as they should. So could you talk a little bit about how that has impacted our work and how we hope to respond?
That LAF was committed to this work before we saw the Me Too movement, and we remain just as committed to it. So I don't know that it's impacted how we respond to it as LAF. It's hard to tell this early on how it's impacted the work we do. I do think now that it's more visible, there's been more visibility on the education law issues, mm-hmm. The changes that this administration has been contemplating making to Title IX, I think has been more on people's minds and has had somewhat of an impact on the school cases that we work on here at LAF. Mm-hmm. In terms, we've seen everything from schools being more emboldened to not take our clients' claims of sexual assault seriously mm-hmm. because of the proposed regulations, to the opposite yeah. of schools who feel like they don't like where the changes are going and want to stay committed to survivors. Mm-hmm. So that has made it slightly more challenging. It's hard to tell whether just the movement itself has influenced or changed the way judges or our decision makers think. I think our practice group director, Jennifer Payne, would kill me here if I didn't bring up the fact I actually referenced Me Too in a closing argument at a civil no contact order hearing. We ended up winning the hearing, and it was a very, very difficult case. Mm-hmm. So I won't say that my reference of it won the case. There was other good things we did in the hearing. But we certainly raised the issue to the judge. Yeah. The opposing counsel was trying to argue that our client had waited a year to report the sexual assault and therefore she wasn't credible. And I took the opportunity to respond in closing and say, if anything, that makes her more credible. We see all of these celebrities waiting 10, 20, 30 years yeah. to report a sexual assault or sexual misconduct that happened to them. So good for our client that she mm-hmm. only waited a year.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think we have always worked with these client survivors, I know in IWR specifically, and in all the practice areas really, but in working with low-wage workers who are often sexually harassed at work, working with immigrant survivors who are often victimized because they're vulnerable, it's always been work that we have been doing. I do like that the Me Too movement has shed a light to people who are outside of this sphere to be like, hey, this is happening, and it's impacting all of these people who normally don't have access to attorneys and you know, they don't normally want or are able to enforce their rights. I was going to ask, you mentioned the education in the cases that you're doing there. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. So I have also been working somewhat on the education cases with the education law team. Before I came to LAF, I specialized in Title IX issues. So here at LAF, we have filed two Title IX complaints against Chicago Public Schools, which are currently open investigations by the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. We do so much more than that, though. That is maybe more of the bigger impact work that we do in education, but we have helped many individual clients get accommodations at their school after mm-hmm. being sexually assaulted, or a safety plan in place, or safety measures, or a transfer if that's what they want. And in addition, for some sexual assault survivors, either they had a pre-existing trauma mm-hmm. or other issue which caused them to need an individualized education plan, or the sexual assault itself led to some mental health issues that caused them to need an individualized education plan, and we help advocate in those arenas under special education in schools.
And is this because, just to clarify, is the sex assault happened somewhere else and there's a ramification of the trauma and that's why they need these services, or do sometimes the sex assault happen at the school?
Both,
yeah.
We definitely have both types
wow.
of cases.
Mm-hmm. And when the sex assault happens at school, can you just discuss a little bit about the procedures there?
So they have changed recently, mm-hmm. and we're not, we haven't heard from Chicago Public Schools. They haven't given us anything in writing about their new policies and procedures. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm not even beginning to speak about all the schools in the suburbs, yeah. because every school has different. But under federal law, every single school in this country that receives federal funding is supposed to have a Title IX policy in place and a Title IX coordinator that students can go to after being sexually assaulted to find out their options. Now, when a school is aware of a sexual assault, where a perpetrator is a member of the school community, they are required by that federal law to investigate. Mm-hmm. We saw almost no schools doing this before the overhaul, but as a result, actually, of one of our Title IX complaints against Chicago Public Schools, by some reporting by the Chicago Tribune last spring, there has been, Chicago Public Schools has overhauled the way they handle, and they now have an Office of Student Protections. We have some clients who are going through that procedure, and the jury's still out on whether it's a good one or not.
Yeah, well, that's an amazing, I think, progress and success, so that's really fantastic that we're able to participate in that. Can you talk a little bit about what you find rewarding about this work? If anything.
This work is very rewarding to me. I've been working on violence against women issues since I was in high school. This issue has always been really important to me because I feel it's a major barrier holding women back from having full equality. And for a long time, I did volunteer work and research into domestic violence. During graduate school, I started to do research on rape and the response to rape survivors, and I felt that sexual assault had much fewer resources than domestic violence, and you can even see it coming into LAF. When I started here, I was hired to specialize in sexual assault cases. They had just started the CLASP I mm-hmm. grant, which was the first work they were doing, but they had all of the lawyers devoted to domestic violence, and many of the other agencies in Chicago also devote a lot of time and resources to domestic violence. Very few organizations focus on sexual assault. And a lot of times the sexual assault is part of the domestic violence, as we've discussed. But for people who aren't sexually assaulted by their intimate partner, what resources do they have and where do they have to go? So for me, it was a matter of helping those who are most vulnerable in our population.
I love that. I think I see the same trend in the work that we did in IWR, specifically when we were focusing so much on domestic violence survivors to help them obtain their immigration remedies. And suddenly when we had this special funding, we were able to say, hey, there's all these people at these low-wage jobs, hotels, restaurants, housekeeping, who are constantly harassed, constantly mistreated, and sexually abused. And we're not really doing much for them. And this grant definitely allowed us to increase our services to that group, which I think, as you mentioned, are some of the most vulnerable people and do not have access to many services. So I agree this is also very rewarding work, because especially with working with workers who then learn about their rights and have to enforce them and have to, they really just come out of it a little bit more empowered. Sometimes, I mean, obviously they've gone through something super traumatic and it's horrible, but it is nice at least to see how the legal system can help a little bit. Can we talk a little bit about the difference between the criminal justice system and the civil legal system and the major gap that exists there?
Yeah, so a lot of people are confused by this. I have a lot of clients coming to me saying they want to get a civil no contact order because they want the perpetrator to go to jail. Well, the civil system has nothing to do with jail. The criminal justice system deals with punishments involving jail or, probation, things like that. And that system is completely up to the police and the prosecutor. I wish that I had influence on that, but that's completely in the state's hands as to what to do, how to pursue that. And that, in that system, you need more evidence to prove, especially a sexual assault. You need to convince a judge or a jury that the perpetrator committed a sexual assault beyond a reasonable doubt. In the civil system where I work, the burden is lower, and we don't have jury trials either. It's only in front of a judge. We have to convince a judge that this person sexually assaulted a survivor only by a preponderance of the evidence. When we win in the civil system, all we get is a 2-year order saying that the perpetrator has to stay away from our client. Mm-hmm. They're not punished. There's no money exchanging hands. All the client wants is just this piece of paper that says he cannot come near me, or contact my family members. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of the major differences between the two systems. And sometimes a client wants to pursue both systems, but a lot of times they don't even have the option for the criminal system. And so civil no contact order is their only option to have somebody acknowledge that they were sexually assaulted.
No, I agree. It's very interesting when you do domestic violence, and because of the connection to the offender, it's sometimes a barrier for the survivor to press charges because there's so much nuance in situations happening as to why they don't want to press charges. I have many clients who are survivors of sex assault who want to press charges, and they're just completely dismissed or ignored, or it's too hard, quote unquote, because it's he said, she said. And as you mentioned before, like, how do you prove force if there's like no smoking gun, essentially? And it's so frustrating for clients because they come here, and especially a lot of my clients are immigrant survivors as well, who don't understand how the system works here. And say, for example, we decide that we can sue an employer or someone, there might be money exchanging hands because that's how the civil legal system works. And it's very hard for them to kind of reconcile because they don't really want this money. They want what they perceive as justice, which isn't, it's really someone, I think, taking them credibly and really kind of holding the perpetrator accountable. And that doesn't really happen as often as it should with the clients that we work with. So I think part of this is really helping them understand the civil legal side and kind of making them at least semi-comfortable with understanding, like, these are the remedies that exist, and it's imperfect, but it's kind of all we got. And, you know, I think at the end, some of them do feel very, I guess, as okay with the situation, you know, going forward with everything. But, I do find it rewarding as well. And can you tell us, though, because obviously you're dealing with clients who are telling you about their traumatic experiences, you do have to get into the weeds, into the detail. How do you balance that from your own personal life? How do you de-stress, and how do you keep that out of your normal day-to-day life?
Oh, Nubia, what a question. What a question. Before I started at LAF, I had the 56-hour training with Resilience. Back then they were called Rape Victim Advocates. And I actually volunteered as to be one of the first responders. So when somebody is sexually assaulted at a Chicago hospital, the hospital is required to call the police and Resilience. And so I would be one of the volunteers that they would send, like, immediately when the client is like in the hospital, usually right after the sexual assault happened. And Resilience told us that when you're faced with it, not to worry, you're going to go into advocate mode. And they're right. When you're in that situation, you do go into advocate mode. And the same thing happens in my job as an attorney. I'm in total advocate mode. I'm getting the information I need. And a lot of what keeps me going is knowing that if I wasn't there, they'd have to face the perpetrator on their own. And so I know I have to be strong for them because otherwise they're on their own. So I take it very seriously. And part of balancing that out in my personal life is having really supportive and good coworkers that I can complain to any time of day or even after work hours about the stuff that we deal with, having supportive supervisors who understand when you need to take a break or step away from a case or need extra support on a certain issue. But it's also just setting those boundaries and being able to leave work at work and work out or spend time with friends and family after work hours. But I'm sure all of us at LAF have those struggles, not just the people who work with survivors.
No, I mean, absolutely. I think part of the work in poverty law is traumatic, and you're dealing with people who are being mistreated and abused, and it's hard. But I think I agree with the supportive workplace, and also just the setting of the boundaries definitely helps. And I think it can be a struggle for some people, but if you're here for the long haul, that's like the number one thing you have to learn how to do. So we're almost at the end, and I just want to ask the question I ask all the guests who come, and that is, why does legal aid matter to you?
Legal aid matters to me because we are helping the most vulnerable members of our community get assistance and trying to make their lives whole again. And for many people, we give them stability that they would not have otherwise had if they had not come to us. I see many of my clients are in such better places emotionally and even sometimes physically after we've finished working on their case, because LAF does so much more than just a piece by piece, you know, on somebody's individual case. We have the client support services team, which have social workers who are able to help our clients with resources, and we deal with every type of civil law, so your client is just going to be completely covered. And to me, you know, I've grown up in Chicago, and it's really wonderful to be able to give back to a community that I've been so successful in and that has given me so much. And I think legal aid is just important to help the most vulnerable members of our society stand on their own two feet and to assist them in doing that.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate all your time and the information you gave us. And I want to thank everyone for listening, and please join us in the next episode.
This has been Legal Aid Matters. We're produced and edited by Ronald Tippin, John Gilmer, and me, Ashton Shelton. Our music is by Poddington Bear, and our amazing host is Nubia Willman. Thank you for listening.